Okay, I reckon you look pretty tense to me. Quite anxious. Talk to me.
Really? I look anxious.
Super wound up.
Welcome to All the Best Australia. I'm Samantha Groth. Today we're talking about how internal differences can lead to changes in political leadership for Australia's major parties, all in a very short period of time. Just kidding. Let's escape that noise. You're listening to All the Best, and this week we're fleeing the real world. We're delving into books, movies, fan clubs, and then we're watching those fantasies bring us right on back to reality. You'll be hearing about the personal impact of watching The Wizard of Oz soon, but you know, it's always best to read the book first. It's been a while since producer Sarath Chandra has read a book, so he tried to rekindle his love of literature by talking to two authors, and along the way, he met a bibliotherapist.
Hi, my name is Oliver Pomervan, and I'm a children's author and a part-time stand-up comedian. I grew up on a staple of Seinfeld and Jimon and classic Australian comedy, and I wanted to give stand-up a crack, but deep down inside, it was because I wanted to be a funny writer.
Oliver Pomervan is sweet as pie. He's like an Asian Australian Where's Wally, but with spiky hair.
Growing up, I was a bit of a weird kid myself. I mean, yes, I was a class clown. And yes, I made kids laugh and got in trouble all the time. And, you know, I was the entertainer, but I didn't actually really have any friends. You know, looking back, you know, yes, you know, the kids would laugh at me, but outside the classroom, they would just go off and play handball or, you know, play with their footy cards and stuff. And I'd just kind of be on my own.
Oliver felt like a walking meme. He was good for a laugh for some of the kids, but nothing more.
I had to come up with my own imagination, so I basically played with my own toys. I brought toys to school, and I used to pretend to be a dinosaur. I used to roam around, and, you know, the library was my sanctuary, you know. That was where I could actually, like, you know, read books and really get lost in adventure and fantasies.
Oh, he really loved books.
4 years straight, I won the Best Borrower's Book Award, which is the most books ever borrowed, and I managed to beat this kindergarten kids who kept borrowing books, but I still beat them.
He was also into dinosaurs. A dangerous combination.
I could tell you how big the Stegosaurus plates were and, you know, all that kind of random facts that had no useful application outside of school. But, you know, I guess I got lost into books, and the pang of not having real friends sort of subsided when I actually did, like, you know, sort of read, I guess. So, I mean, it's a bit of a cliche to say books were my friends, but they really were.
Books gave Oliver lots of things. Friendship. Compassion, the great twist ending and punchlines. But one book in particular had a big impact on him.
There's this great Paul Jennings story where this kid wants to embarrass his dad and his dad's boss who comes over for dinner, and he tries to outgross him in all these different ways and nothing's really working. And then he pulls out a fly swatter and starts licking it. And I just thought that is full on gross, but he's dedicated to his art of really getting in trouble. And he gets in trouble, of course. But what you don't know to the very end is that it's actually like sultanas and stuff that he's stuck on to look like fly guts. And I'm like, that is gold. That's the kind of stuff that I wanted to write about.
Yeah, yeah. You should be getting a Pulitzer for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, 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 for sure. Why must I always play the clown? It makes it too easy for them to put you down. It's too late, too late, too late, too late, too late to wash my face and hands. I'm too late to get too high, to get too late.
Oliver credits Paul Jennings as inspiration for him becoming a children's writer.
First funny book that I ever wrote was Tyrific. So that was my first kids book. And I guess I didn't expect to write for kids, to be honest. I actually wanted to write for adults. And so in uni, all my stories were quite dark, a little bit satirical.
And the stories he writes are for kids just like him.
I always wanted to be a voice for the weird kids, you know, like most of my stories are all about me. But in a general sense, they're about families and friendships, you know. And so I love writing about unlikely friendships. Only until I became a primary school teacher did I realize that, you know, I'm still a big kid myself. I still play a lot of games. I'm you know, still young at heart, per se. And so I gave kids writing a crack, and I haven't looked back since then.
For Oliver, books help him feel less alone, but also inspired his career path. But the impact of a book can sometimes take a lifetime to sink in.
From when I was a really little child, actually, I used to be the one making the school newspapers with Snoopy on the cover, I have to say, when I was at primary school.
Emma Harcourt is a journalist and a published author. And for her, it took her some time.
I was that person that every year on New Year's Eve would say, this is the year I'm going to start the book, you know, this is the year. But life gets busy. Takes a lot of courage to take a step back from that and choose something which has the potential to fail.
It took her 20 years to actually do it, and it wasn't until 2011 when she took the leap and started writing a deeply personal story.
The story is based on my grandparents. My grandparents lived in Shanghai in China in the 1920s. They're both Aussies. My grandmother was a very independent woman for her day.
For the 20s, her grandma was a total badass.
So she basically hopped on a motorbike and drove from country New South Wales to Sydney and hopped on a boat for Hong Kong and was being hassled by guys on the boat and went to the crew for protection, and that one of them was my grandfather.
The inspiration to write about her grandma first came to Emma a long time ago when she was in her 20s.
I read a book called A Room of One's Own by Virginia Woolf, which is a short book, but it's about... I mean, she wrote it in the 1920s and I read it in the early 90s and it was as relevant then for me. And I was a young wife really feeling lost, unsure of who I was, definitely not able to hear my own voice. And that book really shook me up, actually. It was kind of inspiring and terrifying at the same time because she challenged what I was living. That actually made me sit up and just think, what am I doing? And I felt really uncomfortable.
Take the bass line out. Uh-huh. 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 Yeah. Let it bump, though. Uh-huh.
Emma kept going back to that one challenge of figuring out who she really was, and that discomfort helped her find the answer, to become a writer of fiction. And Emma reckons being a fiction writer can be more powerful than writing nonfiction, especially when you as a reader connect with someone that you can identify with.
Sometimes that means they have more impact because they actually get in under your skin and sit there because you're living with that character and you're sharing an experience that then sometimes you don't even know is starting to change the way you might view a part of your life.
Both Emma and Oliver had a book that had this huge impact on them to not only inspire their career but also change their outlook on how they see the world. And I've been wondering why I haven't had a similar experience. Maybe I missed out on something in high school. Maybe I read Dylan Thomas wrong. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Or did I miss the point of 50 Shades of Grey? Christian unlocks the door, his mouth in a grim line. Are you ashamed of me? No, it's my turn to sound exasperated. Introduce you to my dad as what? This is the man who deflowered me and wants to start a BDSM relationship? You're not wearing running shoes. Either way, I'm not feeling satisfied with my relationship with books. I want a book to have an impact on me. You know, it doesn't have to change too much. I just feel like I've been missing out on something. But it turns out there's a professional you can see for cash money about this exact problem. And they're called bibliotherapists.
Bibliotherapy is reading with purpose. It's reading for emotional engagement and nourishment. You know, the idea that you can use books to comfort, console, enter new worlds, develop empathy, or even challenge
you. This is Jermaine, a qualified bibliotherapist, but it's also not...
Well, let me just interrupt there and say, bibliotherapy, however, is about making your intent for reading obvious and to help you obtain emotional nourishment.
Nourishment. There's a lot of nourishment there, Jermaine.
All right, okay. I reckon you look pretty tense to me, quite anxious. Talk to me.
Really? I look anxious.
Super wound up, like a grandfather clock. Like a grandfather clock.
Let's do this, but now you pretending to be You know, you can up the therapeutic voice.
Okay.
And I guess the key beats.
I did actually see Jermaine, who is a qualified bibliotherapist, so she says, but I stuffed up the recording and the recording was too low. So this is my friend, Karishma.
It seems like when you're not intellectually stimulated or lacking meaningful connections in your life, you go to fantasy books. Which, you know, that's fine, it's perfectly healthy. But, you know, when you're satisfied intellectually, you turn to nonfiction. So you, this is a pattern. I can see a pattern here, and I'm surprised you really haven't picked up on this, actually, Sarath.
Pattern.
Yeah, definitely a clear pattern. So, okay, so let's just hear me out. So maybe why you're not happy with the books you are reading is because you're not picking the right books.
Karishma was right about that one thing. I wasn't picking the right books.
For you, it's about getting in touch with your emotions.
Okay.
Though Special K did take a few liberties with her impression of Jermaine, the real Jermaine did actually recommend I reread some of the books I read as a kid, which sadly included 50 Shades of Grey.
Really don't like 50 Shades of Grey. I really hate that book.
Oh, it's just too bad. You're going to have to read it. It's my prescription at least definitely four times at least. Bibliotherapy is about challenging your views, Sarath. So, you know, maybe 50 Shades of Grey is just what you need.
So what I learned from all this, aside from the importance of recording things and the concept of a qualified bibliotherapist, is that if you find the right book, it can change your life. But if you're struggling to find that book, well, you're just not looking hard enough. So what are you waiting for?
That story was produced by Sarath Chandra, with help from supervising producer Mike Williams. Thanks also to Oliver Pomavan, Emma Harcourt from Harlequin Publishing, and Karishma Tanvi. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Samantha Groth. All the Best is a show for new and emerging audio documentary makers to pitch, produce, and learn. If you pitch an awesome story idea to us, we'll also pay you with a supervising producer. Email us at contact@allthebestradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Sydney-based artist David Capra is a big fan of the movie The Wizard of Oz. He knew his passion for it at a young age and even joined the International Wizard of Oz fan club when he was about four. But being a fan doesn't just mean you know about all the good parts of the film. Sometimes you click your heels three times and it's the truth that comes home.
My grandmother had gone through war camps in Nazi Germany. She spoke about it a little with my mother and her siblings, but when it got to my generation, she was ready to talk about it a whole lot more. So there was lots of stories of seeing Hitler speak from balconies and violence, and she was quite cautious of the world, as you can imagine. Just the way she presented the world to me was a very cautious and foreboding view of the world. It became normal for my first interaction with things, anything, to be frightened or fearful. I have this strong memory of spending a lot of time with her on Friday nights, which was when the Friday night movie was on, including The Wizard of Oz. There were a few rules. There wasn't allowed to be any lights on in the house at all. You'd often hear the sound of cockroaches being trampled on underneath my grandma's bare feet as she walked through her fibre house. And if you're looking in from the street, it would look like fireworks were going on because lights were down and you could see all these kind of the colours piercing through their Venetian blinds. And the reason for this, she thought that if she was caught being up at a late hour, the police would be knocking on her door and asking her why she was up at that hour. And so even the volume on the TV had to be really, really, really low, so you just heard it.
I don't like this forest. It's dark.
I have strong memories of being around four or five. My grandmother had this colour television that she had since the 70s. It was all wood veneer and it sat in the middle of her lounge room.
Do you suppose we'll meet any wild animals?
Which one of your phrase?
I distinctly remember watching the scene where the trio down the yellow brick road meet the cowardly lion. I have a really strong, vivid kind of, it almost feels out of body, but I can actually feel myself. It's a very visceral memory. I think I really identified with them being initially quite afraid of this lion. I remember the fear of seeing it and it being quite a dramatic moment in the film. And then when that's broken down, you realize that he isn't who he thinks he is, or, you know, he's in fact a cowardly lion, and he was quite gentle and sensitive.
You're right, I am a coward. I haven't any courage at all.
The lesser known parts of the film where there isn't any dialogue and it's just the actual backing score to the dialogue. And, you know, it's really full blown, the big MGM orchestra. It's quite magical. And my favorite moment is the moment where there's just cascading all these musical themes kind of blend into one, where Dorothy is clicking her heels and she's going back to Kansas at the end. And it's got, you know, moments of Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and then what sound like some sort of baby lullabies, and then it goes into this kind of big orchestra. Well, for me, when I was a child, it was about friendship, actually. Like, they were all sort of misfits, but being welcomed into this space. And it was a lot about design as well. It was where I think as a child I really decided I wanted to be an artist. By watching this film, I fell in love with color and creating these spaces for people to escape to. It's nurturing, I think, but it's also really quite bizarre. Well, you filled out a form and sent it back, and then you got a little International Wizard of Oz Club membership card. I was getting the Born Bugle in the mail every few months. The Born Bugle is named after L. Frank Baum, who wrote The Wonderful Wizard of Oz in 1900. It's quite academic, and there's a whole list of odds and ends, they call it. So where The Wizard of Oz has featured in, say, maybe like sitcoms on TV or YouTube. And the newsletter was a resource for me to connect with this concept of a film that was made, you know, 50 years ago. So I was really introduced to it during the 50th anniversary, which was 1989. And so being part of this club felt extraordinary, because it was all the way in America and I was like living in the suburbs of Sydney, and it was the first time that I really felt connected to community, and community has become a big part of my art practice. It does have international members. I think I'm one of seven from Australia. They have big Wizard of Oz conventions, and I never thought in my wildest dreams that I would actually be able to attend one, but I actually attended one about 2 years ago, and it was in Chittenango, where L. Frank Baum was born. There was a Wizard of Oz auction. There was a slideshow all about the horse of a different colour who appears in the film. So it's quite obsessive, and I really loved these people. Like, I spent the evenings playing Oz-themed Uno with them. We ate Oz-inspired meals. So it was quite it was 4 days, and it was quite intense. But it was confronting as well, because The Wizard of Oz is so personal and so close to my heart, and then to see people have that same connection, it was like, no, that's, it's my Oz. Follow the yellow brick road, follow the yellow brick road, follow, 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 follow,
follow the yellow brick road. How did you actually become a munchkin in the film The Wizard of Oz in 1939?
Yes.
A long time ago.
And before I was born, huh? No. Yes.
That's right.
Actually, I had just turned 7.
Okay.
Betty and Bruno was one of 12 children that was employed to just fill the background of the Munchkin scenes. During that same trip, I actually went to the soundstage of Munchkinland, which was an incredible experience. She talked about being on set, and she talked about knocking on the trailer of Judy Garland across the 2 weeks, asking almost every day for an autograph. meeting Betty Ann and going to the Wizard of Oz convention was all about confronting this notion of fantasy. It kind of was a little bit upsetting because you actually kind of step into these realms of fantasy. There's nowhere really to go. You can only go forward. You can't look back and go back to this place of fantasy because you've kind of encountered it in a real sense, in a visceral sense. And it really made me think about how nostalgic I am as a person and how that can be wonderful but also problematic.
There's some sort of phrase thrown around like, don't meet your heroes. And I've heard people talk about that where they've met their heroes and you sort of project whatever it is that you'd been holding on to. I'm wondering if you had that sort of experience meeting Betty Ann in person.
Well, no, it was a positive experience meeting Betty Ann, but it was also just, you know, reflecting on it. The Wizard of Oz, the film, was just a constructed film of its day. Snow White had come on the scene 2 years prior. It was MGM's response to Walt Disney's Snow White, and it was there to make money. And the stories you hear on set, how Judy Garland was basically drugged up, and the studio would actually prescribe as some sort of cocaine, because at the time people worked 5 movies at a time. It kind of made me start breaking it all down, and I couldn't access the film like I was when I was 5 years old. I had seen it for something else. And you know, Betty Ann does talk about a story which is really unsettling. She recounts how one of the little people aged in their 40s took an extra liking to her and tried quite hard to have some time alone with her, and she was, I think, 6 at the time.
He kept asking my mother if he could take me to lunch. And every time he came up and asked her if he could take me to lunch, she would grab me and clutch me to her bosom in the most protective way. Oh, he found out that my favorite candy bar was an O. Henry bar, and he just asked me that. So every morning, midges would come by, and I'd be in this room. And he would come by the glass door, and he would look in until he found me. And then he would reach in his coat pocket, and he'd pull out an O. Henry bar, and he'd go.
Did he know you were 7 years old? Or
of
did
course.
He? Yes.
That was very confronting. I was really not expecting her to be sharing such a thing. And Hollywood was a really problematic place back then, of course. I mean, it still is. Judy Garland's bus were actually tied down for her to play the role of Dorothy, who's only meant to be 12, and she was 16 at the time. The actor who played Auntie Em took her life with a plastic bag years after the film. So there is a dark history to that film as well. And you have this idea of it, and when you look deeper, it's not what it seems. I think I didn't know how to watch the film again after going on that trip, because it was too confronting to confront all the things I'd unpacked about the film, and that it lost its magic. But I really believe that I've kind of rediscovered it again, and it still remains very, very close to me. It was there when, you know, as a young boy, and I'm quite frightened of the world, and now it was with me in my teenage years, and now it's with me as an adult. But it kind of, you know, it sits alongside you like an old friend. And I really feel like I've learnt a lot from it. It has always showed me the importance of true friendship, and I think it will be with me when I'm very old.
That story was by Alison Chan and Gregory J. Thorsby. Thanks to Sarah O'Malley for production assistance, and to David Capra for letting us use his interview with Betty Ann Bruno. You can also catch David Capra on Canvas, FBI Radio's Arts and Ideas show, on Sundays at 11 a.m. This episode of All the Best was compiled by Jess Meyer with Sarah O'Malley. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Alison Chan. And hey, our new Victorian state coordinator is Jordan Fennell, And our new SYN community coordinator is Victor Mims. Welcome to the fam. Our community coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Matilda Fay is our social media producer. And I'm Samantha Groth, your host. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and find all of our other episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so if you need to escape through your ears, subscribe and give us a review in your favourite podcast app.